Hi, welcome to Holden Village's Theological Conference, sponsored by the Lutheran Educational Network and Support. This morning's session will be on small groups and disciplining in local ministry, with our speaker, Dr. Brunner. Let's listen in.
This will be a combination of some theological and some ecclesiological and then some just practical stuff. But on the back of your page is, I don't know how widespread this is, but this is the Search Institute study that has been, it was done in 1990, of six major denominations, five mainline and Southern Baptists. And it measures faith maturity. It was written about in the Lutheran, in the issue here, just a little bit in the Lutheran, in 1990, into the 90s. You can order a copy of this study. It measures faith. I know that that's a terrible thing, but also know that the Search Institute is a Lutheran organization. So at some level, we have to claim this. We don't have to, but it is a Lutheran organization. They measured faith on with eight criteria. I don't want to go through all of those. You can get the research and look at it. Through eight criteria, four of them were related to the vertical dimension of faith. So that vertical dimension would be one's relationship with God and one's relationship to the community that is called by God. And so they had four different criteria that related to the vertical dimension of one's, it has to do with passion, it has to do with a sense of God's presence in one's daily and active life. And then four of the criteria related to the vertical dimension, to the question of Christian community, to the question also of justice and peace in the world. So it really, and then it just, through the study, it came up with undeveloped faith meant weakness, quote unquote, and I don't mean weakness in the theology of the cross sense. I mean weakness in that it's not existent. Vertical faith meant all you had was vertical. All that scored was vertical. Horizontal meant all that scored was horizontal. And integrated meant that they were together. And this is, I photocopied this right out of the study that you can order for yourself. I want you to notice a couple of things. If you're from the Missouri Synod, I have done this before with Missouri Synod. I don't know how you compare, how LCMS compares with the ELCA. I simply don't know. Let's hope that you're close to us. I mean, that you're different from us. But I speak only as ELCA. If you look down the left-hand column, you'll see the six denominations that were studied. Christian Church Disciples of Christ, ELCA, Presbyterian Church USA, Southern Baptist, United Church of Christ, and United Methodist. If you look down the very first column, and what's in bold, undeveloped faith, and you go down to the ones that are bold, all adults, you'll see that Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, undeveloped faith is 47%. If you compare that with all the other denominations, you'll find that far and away, the ELCA has the lowest faith, most undeveloped faith maturity in the country. The most undeveloped faith maturity in the country. If you go to the far right-hand column, you'll see in terms of integrated faith that we have the lowest level of integrated faith. So we have the highest undeveloped, the lowest integrated. This holds true across the board in terms of clergy as well. 11% of ELCA clergy have undeveloped faith. That means no vertical or horizontal. How is that possible? I mean, that's what Our Lady are asking, actually. How is that possible? I also want you to notice something else. I hang around evangelicals. I am a visiting professor at Western Evangelical Seminary, which is Wesleyan Holiness in background. I actually like evangelicals. I am keeping a list of all the cruel things that mainlines say about evangelicals. And I am becoming fairly persuaded that evangelicals are the most persecuted and the most downtrodden people in terms of mainlines that I know in America. We just absolutely obliterate them with stereotypes. We rip them to pieces. around them a lot. I hang around them a lot. And most of our stereotypes are simply untrue. Evangelicals? Evangelicals would be, this would be, in terms of denominational, the evangelicals of the denomination that I work at would be Quaker, Assembly of God, Nazarene, Free Methodist, those, and there is a denomination called the Evangelical Denomination. So those would be the ones that I, that are at the seminary. So those are the ones that I can always speak to. I also want you to look, however, one other thing in here. I want you to look at the Southern Baptists. Now, I want you to notice in the undeveloped faith of the Southern Baptists that they have the lowest level of undeveloped faith and that they have far away the highest level of integrated faith. That includes both vertical dimension and their work with peace and justice. Now, I want you to also notice one other thing about the Southern Baptists. I want you to notice that if they make a mistake, if they err on the side of vertical or horizontal, So where do the Southern Baptists place their emphasis as they train their clergy and their leaders for the church? It's placed first on the vertical and then on the horizontal. And the vertical flows from the horizontal. Now, I don't want to get into a mentality of comparison, and I know that this is very, very, very dangerous. But I think it at least is indicative. And ultimately, I want us to ask a question, and I want us to wrestle with the issue of why is there not a Lutheran ethos for spiritual maturity, for faith maturity? Why is there not a Lutheran ethos about that? Can I add one more thing to this? This has to do with last night what Timothy was talking about in terms of grace. This study also points out, and I'll try to read you the exact question if I can find it. Yes. The question has to do with what we believe. And the question is, I believe I must obey God's rules and commandments in order to be saved. It's the question of grace. 61% of Lutherans answered that affirmatively. We talk about being the denomination of grace. 61% of Lutherans believe they must obey God's rules and commandments in order to be saved. 42% of Southern Baptists do. We are not the denomination of grace, people. We are not. And I wish, when I hear us talking about grace, if we're talking about it, and if we understand it, for whatever reason, we're not communicating. I encourage you to get a hold of this study. This thing is mind-boggling. This is mind-boggling. I want to take you quickly to another study. And this whole thing is very painful for me. This is very difficult for me because I, as someone who likes evangelicals, I know that the perception is that I don't care about grace, and that really what I care about is legalism, and that's really what's important to me. And so what I'm going to share sounds kind of close to that. And I hate to do it, but I'm going to do it anyway. There is a book by it's in the bibliography, Roger Finke, Rundstar, called The Churching of America, 1776-1990. I know some of you probably have looked at this. This book is a sociological study, and it basically critiques, and I think very, very thoroughly, the idea that the mainline denominations had a spurt of growth in the 50s and have been declining since the 60s. What they say is that mainline denominations have been in decline since 1776. There has not been a period of growth, numerically. There has not been a time when they've been growing across the board. But there are denominations that are. in America. And I think this is part of what, I don't think, part of it is as someone who is somewhat of a historian from the 17th, 18th centuries when Lutherans first came over here. Part of the struggle that Lutherans have had since the very first time we came over here is we've never discovered what it meant to be American. Whenever we needed some kind of help, we always have written to Europe and said, send us over clergy. Please send us clergy. Other denominations were able to make the adjustment, but we didn't. Their thesis statement is there are denominations and sects and cults that are growing. Mormonism, Jehovah's Witnesses. And the other denominations that are growing are the Wesleyan Mormons. The very people that I found myself hanging around. A number of years ago, Dean Kelly, who was the head of the NC's National Council of Churches, wrote a book on why conservative churches are growing, and he got hammered for it. These guys take him to task at a level. But this is what they say, and please listen, and take it for what it's worth, but it has to do with eventually where we're going with this. Then, he says, we will move to develop the proposition that religious organizations are stronger to the degree that they impose significant costs in terms of sacrifice and even stigma upon their members. Religious organizations grow to the degree that they impose significant costs in terms of sacrifice and even stigma upon their neighbors, members. I want you to think for a minute about Mormonism. That requires a 10% tithe right on the bank account of its members. If you're a member of that church and you know that 10% of your money is going into an organization, aren't you going to care what that organization does? If 10% of your salary, you as ELCA, Missouri Synod Clergy, goes into the Board of Pensions, don't you care what the Board of Pensions does with it? Aren't you fairly confused? Isn't that something that's important to you? It is. And what they have said is that year after year and year after year, mainline denominations have been asking less and less and less and less of their members. They've been asking less. Now, is this legalism? We're going to talk about that. We've got to talk about that. I want to talk about a few theological issues. I want us to relate just a little bit to the question of sanctification. And so those two studies kind of set the context. Sanctification is just an awful thing. It's an awful thing to talk about. Awful thing. The New Testament, if you look at Kittle, the New Testament has at least two different understandings of sanctification. And I don't want to go into these scriptures. You can look them up. These are proof texts, but I'm just taking the word holiness. And you know that they all come from the same Greek word. Hagios gives us holiness, gives us saint, gives us sanctification. They all come from the same rootage, the same Greek roots. And so it's a status conferred on believers. In other words, because of being baptized into Christ Jesus, you are sanctified. It is a done deal. You are a saint. I know you've done the children's sermons on All Saints Sunday where all the children come up and they receive a name tag that has saints in their first name on it. You are a saint. You are a saint. But a part also of the New Testament, and this is the part that we wrestle with as Lutherans, and I don't know why, this is the part I want you to help me with because I don't know why. It's the part that says sanctification is also a process to be pursued. It's a calling to which we're called. That we are called to holiness. We are called to sanctification. We are called to live a life of holiness. And it is the eschatological New Testament thing that happens all the time. It even happens with salvation. We are and we are not yet. And the same thing is true with sanctification. We are sanctified, we are holy, and yet we are not yet. We have not yet reached that. The problem with Luther is that Luther said so little on sanctification. And when he did talk about it, it was basically intertwined with justification. For Luther, justification was the bottom line of it all. And each day was a day of justification. But if you look at his concept of living faith, he can't conceive of the possibility that that a believer's faith would not transform them from the inside out. He couldn't conceive of that possibility. And so, I don't know why he didn't, but he didn't talk about sanctification. Bob said I attended Fuller Seminary. And when I was at Fuller, they said, my candidacy committee said that I would never have friends in the Lutheran church because I didn't go to a Lutheran seminary. So I'm very sad about that. That I don't have friends in the Lutheran church. I was in a spirituality class, and I was sitting with, we had a Nazarene, we had a Reform, we had a Methodist, I was the Lutheran, we had a Presbyterian, and we had a Roman Catholic nun. And we were talking, we all made a presentation on spirituality and from our traditions. And I talked about Simul Iustitia at the cotton. I mean, what else do you talk about as a Lutheran? Yeah, and so I said, I am simultaneously justifying the saint. And there will never be a day, there will never be a day that I will not be a saint. And my Methodist friend just threw up his arms and said, oh my gosh, that's what's wrong with the Lutherans. That explains it. He says, we Wesleyans, we believe that there's a carrot out there that we're always pursuing. And it's holiness. And it's perfect love. It's perfect love. Now, please, don't criticize Wesley's view of perfect love until you've read it. I just ask you, you can criticize it. But please read it before you criticize it. So I asked my witness friend, well, will you ever get that carrot? He said, no. I'll never get it. I'll never get it, but I will strive for it. He says, you Lutherans, you just go through every day saying it doesn't matter. I'm always going to be a sinner. Every day I'm a sinner. Every day I'm a sinner. Now, that just raced for my mind. What is the Lutheran view of the Christian life? What is the Lutheran view of baptism in the daily Christian life? Is it simply every day getting up and recognizing we are baptized and crossing ourselves and saying, that's it? Is that what living the Christian life is? Is that what you as clergy and you as laity would talk to your people about? This is what it means to live the Christian life. It means getting up in the morning and saying, I am baptized. I don't know that. Forget that next Latin phrase. That, I don't know why I put that in there. And I'm going to leave practical atheism down until a little bit later. I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. Ecclesia Reformata, that's Semper Reformanda, is actually not a Lutheran phrase. It's a Reformed phrase. It's a Calvinistic phrase. But the text says, the church is reformed and it's always reforming. Now, Lutherans have tended not to say that. I don't know. Calvinists have allowed themselves to rewrite confessions. There's a new confession that they write. Lutherans don't rewrite their confessions. We're not ever reforming. We're only one time reformed. I didn't know that. That's kind of, I think it's sad. But I didn't know that. I want to talk about discipleship. And what are we talking about? Biblically, we're talking about Matthew 28. Where Jesus at the end says, go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing and teaching. We have often taken the phrases baptize and teach, but that's not the verb in that sentence. The verb in the Greek is to make disciples. That's the verb. There's only one verb. It's to make disciples. And there's three participles to modify. It's to go, baptize, and teach. But the going and the baptizing and teaching are not in themselves. They are means to make disciples. What is discipleship? And why don't Lutherans talk about discipleship? It's probably because the evangelicals talk about discipleship, and that's why we don't talk about discipleship. Evangelicals understand discipleship as someone a little bit further down the road of life's journey, taking someone else by the hand and walking with them. It's what in the Catholic and Anglican communion is known as spiritual direction. But evangelicals have called it discipleship. And discipleship is becoming like the master. It's becoming like the master. And so there is, the word discipline comes from discipleship. The word discipline comes from discipleship. Now, the best illustration that I know of this, it's not the best, it's a illustration. It's the illustration of baseball. Illustration of baseball. I'm a big baseball fan. I can even claim to be a big baseball fan before the Mariners were any good. You do not, to learn baseball, to do baseball, you don't watch a lot of ESPN and read a lot of books and plug in Mickey Mantle's video on Great Hitting or Ted Williams. How do you learn baseball? You get out, you get a bat, and you swing, and you swing, and you swing, and you catch, and you throw, and you catch, and you throw. Until that day comes to the bottom of the ninth. That these disciplines are so ingrained in you that they come natural. That they come natural. What Timothy Lowell talked about the spiritual disciplines last night. That we as Lutherans have so struggled with this because it reeks of works righteousness. It reeks of works righteousness. But can I tell you that from my experience, and it's not vast, and it is very limited, people, when they come to me and they say, Pastor, I want to grow in my life, my spiritual life. I want to grow in my spiritual life. They know what they're saying. You know, is it my job at that point to say, have you properly understood the foundation of grace in your life, and that you are now moving very close to works righteousness? I don't think that's what they want. And what do they need an exhortation? Can I tell you what works righteous, what legalism is? Legalism would be getting up in front of the people and saying, you need to pray. You need to pray. And then walking away. It's just like baseball. You need to go play baseball. And what does the young little girl, little boy look back to the coach and say? Teach me how. People want to know how to pray. They want to know how to pray. And they want to know, the church has classically had spiritual disciplines. It's a part of the historic life of the church. When I was talking to my seminary class a little bit about what was in here, about stigma. And by the way, where we get the word stigmata of St. Francis, but the word stigma, he says, you know, we were just reading about the martyrdom of Perpetua and the stigma in her life. Isn't the early church all about stigma? Isn't the early church all about the stigma? The cost of being Christian. But anyway, I'm not hard about that. I'm under a design for discipleship now. This is a program, and you know, this is a program that we have toyed with and played with. It is not a defined program. It's something that I just throw it out as something for you to think about and to reflect on. We call it In His Steps. We call it In His Steps. And it basically, theologically, it goes back to Marcus Borg believe it or not, and to a man named Dallas Willard, and to a rediscovery of the humanness of Jesus. I agree with whoever said it, and it must have been Dr. Wolf, the Western Church has an unbelievably docetic view of Christ. Unbelievably docetic. And what we find when we read the scriptures is we find that Jesus himself was a man of prayer. Jesus himself. Have you thought about how Jesus read the scriptures? How when he was 12 years old, he's sitting there debating with the authorities? Don't we, in our docetism, believe that he just was born with it? That he knew David and Isaiah and Ezekiel and Moses personally? And he just kind of got it. Isn't it possible that the boy Jesus raised in a synagogue by a loving mother, a loving father, who taught the scriptures? Why does the Son of God pray? Why does the Son of God have to reflect and go away and be quiet in solitude? What did Jesus mean when he says, "You will do greater works than I do"? How did Jesus mix dirt and saliva and put it on a man's eyes and heal, as we heard in the gospel lesson? Don't we presume he switched on his divinity and just zapped the guy? We're all docetics at a level. And Marcus Bohr, Dallas Willard, and others are calling us to a man, a human being, Jesus. To discover Jesus of Nazareth. And all they're asked, and what Dallas Willard says, is if Jesus knew how to live his life. And he prayed, and he knew the scriptures, and he practiced justice and compassion. And he spoke out against the evils in this world, and he's prophetic. And he lived a life of purity. This came, by the way, borrowed it from down at the bottom, James Smith. Bob says, "Where are your Lutheran resources? How come you don't have any Lutheran stuff there?" And I don't know. Please tell me where they are. I want to find them. But Smith has developed 5 areas, and we basically have played with those. We have 4. You can have 2. You can have 1. You can have 8. But we developed 4 areas. He has 5. One is the scriptures. And I'll tell you what we do with this in just a second. 2 is prayer and meditation and silence. 3 was integrity and purity. And what the Wesleyans would call holiness. But that word is too late. Number 4 is justice. And the way that we designed this program was that laity would gather like this on an evening, and we would do 5 weeks, 6 weeks on each one of these issues. I asked them to commit to 25 weeks. This is where I go back to the stigma and to making demands of people. This is not for their salvation. This is not for their salvation. But I think that people are... This is just psychological to me. It's just sociological. And it may not... It's not going to make sense in 20 years. Let's forget about it. But I'm a parent. And if I have a choice of 2 classes on learning to raise and deal with my teenagers, one class they'll do in 2 hours, and one class is going to be over the course of 6 months, meeting weekly, with discussion and reading, and a paper. Which do you think I would be more likely to go to if I really cared deeply about the kind of parent I was to my teenager? That's not biblical. That's just psychosociological. I don't want to put it into any kind of... There's some Bible passage I can quote that'll make you see that makes that sound good. I just think it's just logic. So we asked for 25-week commitment. And we have started, we've done it now 3 years. The first year we started with 62, and we ended the year with 57. They want to follow through on this. There's teaching for 6 weeks on prayer, then 6 weeks on scripture, 6 weeks on integrity, 6 weeks on justice and compassion. And we try to make it as practical as we can. Not just the theology of prayer, but how do you pray? How do you stay silent? If you're in spiritual, we'll get to the spiritual direction part. Then what we do is the laity break up into small groups. And then each, those small groups each have a leader that has gone through the program before. And in those small groups, they talk about their lives, they do some sharing, but also what they do is it's a small group for accountability. You know, one of the things that why I believe in small groups, and I'm jumping down just a little bit, but why I believe in small groups. What happens to the people in these small groups is two things. Number one, they share with their group people about their prayer life, and they're going to actually pray with those people. I will tell you, this is very hard for Lutherans. It's very difficult for Lutherans to pray, and to pray out loud. And we have wrestled with this. And they know that in the coming week, when they come back into that small group, they are going to talk about what's happened in their lives. Now, this becomes legalism. If, when they come back, the group says, "You did it! You prayed for 15 minutes each day! Congratulations!" That's legalism. The purpose of any spiritual discipline is not to do the discipline. The purpose of a spiritual discipline is what happens in our hearts and lives and our relationship to God. So when the people come back, if they haven't had their life of prayer, or if they had had their life of prayer, their group asks them, "What did you learn about God? And what is God doing in your life?" So what happens in these small groups is two things. And to me, it's the pastoral question. It's very much the pastoral question. What happens in these two groups is two things. Number one, there's accountability. And number two, there's unconditional love. There's unconditional love and acceptance. I'm not in these small groups. These are small groups of laity, but they're working. They actually go each evening, they go through a liturgy. There's an opening prayer. There's something they read out loud together, a statement of their commitment, a statement of confidentiality that they read out loud. And there's a time of sharing. There's a time of prayer. And they close with the Lord's Prayer. And they go through this liturgy every Wednesday night. It's a liturgy surrounding the spiritual discipline. You know, in our pastoral ministries, I know that I agree with what Tim said last night, that we always need to be a church that emphasizes grace. We always need to be a church that emphasizes grace. And I do believe that the predominance of what happens in these small groups is that people experience grace. But I also think that there are people who, for whatever reason, have become lazy in their Christian lives. There are people who come and sit in my office who basically are lazy. And I need to kick them in the butt. Now that prophetic side of the pastoral office is not one that we talk about very much. It's not a very kind one. I believe it happens best in small groups. It happens the most gently in small groups. So that prologue, I can't possibly describe that. I in general lay that out as a design. Is this just large or small church? Inconsequential. My brother-in-law is an American Baptist pastor. He has a little church of 60 members. He is starting what he calls a spiritual formation group with 5 or 6 of the people who want that in their lives. And it's mutual accountability. He is at the same level that they are. The same level. And they walk through the spiritual formation group workbook is, that's all it is you walk through it. They have 5 traditions. They add on, the 5th that they add on to that I don't do, they add on the tradition of sensitivity to the Spirit. So they identify 5 traditions in church history. The contemplative tradition, the evangelical tradition, the charismatic tradition, the justice tradition, and whatever one I'm missing, tradition. That's charismatic. Holiness. Well, sorry, holiness. The holiness tradition. So it's a little broader, but I narrowed it down to get it down to 5 minutes. I want to open this up for questions. I have a couple issues, and then I want your discussion. The discipler and discipleship. I say this very, very hesitantly. I believe that there is a perception. That's not right. One of the things that I think that lady are surprised at when I talked to them about the seminary education diet, and I was at school, and so I can't say that, but I know they believe it's different from Lutherans, is that I didn't have any course on prayer. I didn't have a course on the spiritual life. I didn't have a course on devotional scripture reading. And the lady the lady are always stunned that when Lutheran clergy get together, they have trouble praying. I know this is Missouri Synod and LCA, but there's a difficult for prayer. We'll pull out our LBWs, we'll read the prayer of the day together. We'll read the occasional service together. We'll get together in our pericope groups, and we'll read from a celebrity. Now, I have to tell you the story. This is a defining moment in my life. There's a defining moment. And I've shared this story with some of you. I've done seminars and stuff on small groups. I've shared this story before. I'll do it much more quickly. But I was in a small group with my wife. And and Signe had gone to the doctor where they had listened to her heart and said, you have an irregular heartbeat. And the doctor, and all these kinds of things, they have to say, and the worst case scenario is that we're going to have to do a valve replacement in your heart. And so we're going to get tested, and we'll hear about the test the following month. Well, and I didn't. What do you do? You just hold her, and nothing to do. We went to our small group on that Sunday night. And Sydney decided to share this with the group. Sydney decided to share with the group what's going on with her own her physical heart. And then one of the members of the group went into the kitchen and poured a little olive oil into a dish and came out to the group and said, Sydney, would you say, can you pray? And the whole small group gathered around her, laid hands on her, and they anointed with her with oil, and they prayed. And I am just blown. I am just weeping my head off. And it's not just the sensitive guy trickled down the thing. I'm snot and everything. It is just porn. It's hard for me. I couldn't find it. It was kind of the Paul sighs and groans. I didn't even know how to approach God. But but my community there. Do you know what struck me? This is what struck me, is that in that small group, my wife was receiving better pastoral care than I could have ever offered to a member of my congregation. This is where I'm not sure I agree with Tim Wolf, that the ultimate responsibility for pastoral care in our congregation is going to fall on us as clergy. I think we have to expand this out much bigger. That there certainly is going to be a role for us as clergy in pastoral care, and there always will be. But much, much better pastoral care can happen in the context of small groups. I'm absolutely convinced. And I've seen it in my own life. Much of what will happen in these quote-unquote spiritual formation groups is that people will simply be telling their stories. And they're going to be sharing their personal, spiritual, life stories. There's going to be people that are hearing them. And they're going to be praying out loud for the very first time in their lives. Many of them, as the Lutherans. And they're going to be reading the Bible. My goal, my whole goal in this is, so where do I come back on this? What am I talking about when I get to the disciple? I'm sorry, I took a little dispersion there. People want to know that their clergy have a devotion to Jesus. They want to know that there's a passion for Jesus. The bottom line here is just simply having a means for you to share your passion for Jesus Christ. My fear is that because of all our concerns that we have now with language, with how we verbalize things, etc., that there is a practical atheism in existence. And what I mean by that is we really don't believe that God is there. We really don't believe that God is there. Our people want to know, and maybe this is what we want to know. We want to really believe. We need to know that God is there. Okay, great. Is it, are we supposed to quit right now? So, and go to lunch? Is that, what?
There's two lunches.
There's two lunches?
Yeah.
Well, what I want to do is talk about this a little bit. And I was going to break you up into small groups, but I know many of you are introverts. We can't stand it when the teachers do that. And I'm an introvert, and I can't stand it when the teachers do that. But I would like us to have a discussion. And it goes back to that very first question. And then it has to, you know, any kinds of discussions. What's the difference? By the way, I wanted to just touch on this just a little bit. Spiritual direction in small groups. Spiritual direction is one-on-one. And discipleship is one-on-one. I know that there are calls out there now for the clergy to be spiritual directors. And I understand that call. And I believe in that call. But it goes back to the same thing of pastoral care. I simply don't have the time to do spiritual direction one-on-one with members in the congregation. So I've created the mutual direction of the Spirit in small groups. And that's what this kind of thing is. I personally am in spiritual direction. I see a Jesuit who helps so that I have that side of my spiritual life is a part of who I am. I will also say, and I believe that this is very important, it's a little bit odd with all of this, it kind of comes out of left field. I am also in counseling. I've been in counseling for 2 years. And that's a very, very significant part of my spiritual journey, is working through issues. They're two completely separate things, counseling and spiritual direction. I'm hoping to come to the end of my counseling session, but it all is part and parcel of what is the sharing of the vision of one's self, that they catch in these small groups. And that does come from the leadership. Okay, why, any other questions you have? But I have some questions for discussion, but any other questions you might have? But why do you think it is that the ELCA ranks lowest among mainline denominations in terms of faith and charity?
I was going to make a couple of comments. You were mentioning the search study, at the beginning. And about 10 years previous to that, they also did a study called the Study of Generations, out of which Walter Unterweger, I guess that was his name, talked about how there was a law orientation. I don't remember whether it was 40% or 60% among Lutherans.
60.
It was the 60. It was 60-40. No. I don't know which way it was. Which?
40.
It was 40% orientation, and you're saying on the basis of that one question, at least it was 61%.
61.
So I'd be interested to see if those two fit together, if there's been a change.
Yeah,
my hunch is that one question, is part of the picture, not the whole thing. This law orientation seemed to be there. Secondly, I guess one of the reasons I think we have that is that we've done a fairly good job of impressing upon people a certain pattern of confirmation precisely before they get, precisely at the time when a certain other kind of awareness of who they are begins, rather than, that whole question, there's lots there, I know. And so it gives us a great start, but that's also where a lot of people stop. And in many pastors' experience, including mine, we haven't found the right handles to pick that up in large numbers. So I think that is part of it. The third comment, last comment I want to make, that this sounds a little, the In His Steps program, and I like that. Like the discipling group you provide, or somebody provides, to provide the leadership to the small groups, is something we ought to talk about.
Right, and I think that actually...
So could you explain a little bit about that?
Well, in the model, where, in other words, where do the small group leaders come from?
Yeah, how do you do
that? I met with them for
yeah.
a lengthy period of time ahead of time.
25 weeks?
The dream world would be you run them through the same program that they're eventually going to go through. So you would spend 20, someone asked Billy Graham, and we can say all we want about Billy Graham. Someone asked Billy Graham, if you were to do anything differently, what would you do different? He'd say, I'd take a group of 12 and for my life. If I were to do it all over again, I wouldn't be a mass evangelist. I'd take a group of 12 and form a life. And I think that for 25 weeks, this was, by the way, I think the great thing of Bethel was not the congregational phase, but the teacher training phase. And that it is that kind of methodology or pedagogy that we're trying to return to in this kind of thing. A commitment that people make, and a commitment to be held accountable. If you were in the Bethel Bible Teachers phase, you had your concept cards and all those kinds of things. There was this kind of friendly accountability. It's a friendly accountability. That's kind of, but yeah, I did. I met with the group ahead of time. The leaders, I met with them ahead of time.
Could I follow that?
Uh-huh.
The Catholic Church has done something like this with what it calls its Renew program.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, a little bit different, but that's the 6 weeks, six different times. The way they're working. Interesting kind of thing. But this is all in 1 year, right?
Yeah, we took this
the
25 from September
weeks.
To May.
Okay. Has it been looked at in terms of doing it 6 weeks, like Bethel, in fact?
Yes.
6 weeks, 6 weeks. So
well, I've handed the program off to Bob, and Bob's doing it again. I think that that's all really a possibility. I think this. I do like the long-term commitment. I do like the one-year commitment. There's something about that. I know, and I've only heard about this distantly. We're really talking about kind of an adult practical catechesis. This is really practical adult catechesis. It's Luther pouring the catechism, etc., into children. It's the same kind of thing. We're talking about catechesis. I also believe that this system, the system of a long-term commitment, is one that we need to explore, and I believe it's already being explored in terms of even introducing people to the faith. In the third century, when people were coming to the church as they were preparing for baptism, it was a multi-year process to get ready for baptism in the third century. I mean, it was a lengthy process. And so that the possibility of people being in a small group and having a long-term teaching in order to... And the psychology again of this is, if this is important enough that they become a member of this church, want me to commit myself, I have a choice between this church, which is going to do it in 4 Sunday mornings, and this church, I don't know anything about faith, and this church, which is asking me to give a year. And I got to do homework. Now, if you're a seeker trying to discover Christianity, and it's an earnest heart's desire, which one's going to be more Kirby? Don't answer that question. You had another comment.
Well, and your question about why did Lutherans come up short in the area of spirituality?
Faith maturity is the language that...
It's one of I think, the classic stories that we hang on to as Lutherans is that our own Luther invested his life, heart, and soul into the disciplines of the church. He beat the hell out of himself, is kind of the impression. And that, by his own claim, it got him nowhere in his relationship with God, other than to arrive at the understanding of the name of God. So I think that's part of where we get confused as Lutherans.
But then the presumption is that he... No, I'm not talking about whips, etc. The presumption is... I'm not talking about asceticism at all. The presumption is that after his... Whether he had a tower experience or not, the presumption is that even after 1525, he never again prayed, he never again read the scriptures devotionally, he never lived a life of justice, integrity, and compassion, that he quit doing that because he realized that was part of his old life and it wasn't part of the new. I don't think that's true. I think he did give away some of the intense ascetic disciplines, and I'm not talking about those. But Luther never gave away the classic spiritual disciplines of prayer, silence, etc.
I think what he discovered was that God was present in his suffering.
Oh.
And that's where he discovered grace. That's what I think happens in small group ministry.
That's why you tell your stories.
In other words, I think what Lutherans can do is turn it around, that the disciplines come to life out of our suffering. That prayer only makes sense. I mean, people who pray, look who's praying in the world right now. It's not North Americans.
I know.
And if it is North Americans, it's North Americans who are somehow tormented because their families are falling apart or whatever. I think the disciplines come out of the suffering. And that's the contribution I think we can make as Lutherans.
And people who write from a broad perspective on the spiritual disciplines recognize that there is a discipline in suffering. That suffering and personal experience is itself a discipline. That no one seeks. If you seek it, it's asceticism. But that it happens to us. And it's probably the most formational in our lives. I agree completely with that.
Which is also to say that, and as Lutherans, we have known this experience, where we have had prayer groups, and we have had Bible study groups, and we have had pericope groups, and if those groups never reach a point of authentic sharing about the actual and real suffering that's going on in their lives, then it does become nothing but a kind of a flop of legalism. And that is part of our experience for many of us.
I wanted to lift up just briefly that Luther in those early years of reform actually envisioned this very kind of ministry. He called it the third form of the church in his descriptions of worship. He had traditional worship, the new German or indigenous worship, and then this third form, and he envisioned house groups in which prayer, Bible study, confession and absolution, even the sacraments would be practiced in the homes. And he said, if my leadership tells me to do it, I'll do it. Right now, I don't have the time to train the people. So this actually goes right back to the beginning. He imagined this kind of small group adult catechesis and spiritual practice.
In the back, yeah.
I teach prayer, I teach, the wholeness concept.
Sorry?
When do you teach the works? Within all of that, you send people out to visit
What there is, for example, within a spiritual formation group notebook is there is a list of sample disciplines in all of these areas. So
So there's a list of 15 sample disciplines under the area of justice and compassion. One of them is write a letter to your senator. Another is make a visit to a nursing home. Another is to...
But you don't conceive of a small group going off doing those things
too. It's possible. Some small groups do that ultimately. Yes. In fact, I really do want to focus pretty strongly that the criticism of small groups has always been navel-gazing and the inward focus. But there is simply no biblical model of small groups for them being other than turning in order to go out. That small groups, if they don't go out, they fizzle out.
Do you hear from your small groups that they, because of studying themselves and learning all these things, that they are going out?
Part of what we do, and this actually goes back to part of what Kirby was talking about, towards the end of this program, we do a spiritual gifts inventory with them. And so, and it's by the way, this is another thing. Folks, you don't have to invent the wheel on spiritual gifts. The evangelicals are so far out ahead of us that we don't even, we have to get binoculars to find out where they are. It's already there, the materials are there, it's all over the place. And they do a much better job than just doing spiritual gifts. They combine it with Myers-Briggs and spiritual gifts and your passions and your hearts, and Kirby, what are your experiences? And especially, what are your painful experiences? And it's the evangelicals that are saying, and if this isn't theology of the cross, I don't know what is, it's the evangelicals that are saying, God never wastes a painful experience. That perhaps if you've gone through the experience of divorce, of the loss of a child, of the loss of a loved one, that perhaps God is calling you to a ministry with those people because of the pain and experience that you've got in your whole life. That happens about two-thirds of the way through this spiritual formation program that we take them, a program we call SHAPE, which is spiritual gifts, hearts, ability, personality, and experiences. And that then equips them to discover what their own gifts are for ministry in the world. Out of all of this has flown a number of ministries that have come out of it. But, I mean, that's not, And then there's a lot of people for whom this doesn't work. I mean, if you do Myers-Briggs, for example, if you're an SP, this is a worthless program. Yeah. This is an absolutely worthless program. You're a Franciscan, and all I have to do is send you out into nature or whatever, and that, you've got to be spontaneous. This is discipline. This is good for SJs and for NFs. NFs want the meaning and the value, and SJs want the structure. Myers-Briggs, I just think in those terms. And so, the hope, part of a whole moral battle that we're having would be helped if we would understand T's and F's. T's, because T's want things. This is a whole different issue. But anyway, to me, you have to know it's part of it. This program's not for everybody. I would never even begin to say that this program's for everybody. Not even.
What would you suggest as one of the best spiritual gift inventories that does take into consideration my experience? I have seen stuff that seems to have that in it as well. And
There's two programs that I think open themselves up very carefully to having the Myers-Briggs element added. They can't do it in any program because Myers-Briggs has to be taught by a qualified Myers-Briggs presenter. But if you have a qualified Myers-Briggs presenter, the two programs that open them up very carefully to it, one is called networking. It's called the Network Program. It's a whole independent movement set in Southern California. And their whole program's on, it's on video, it's in a packet, you buy it, you hand it to a layperson, they teach it. It is, and then you adjust it. But they've done all the work for us. And then you change it theologically, do whatever you want theologically. The other one is called SHAPE, and that comes out of Saddleback Community Church in Mission Viejo. Down the south.
Where is it from?
Saddleback Community Church.
And what does the SHA stand for?
Spiritual gifts, heart, or passions, abilities, personality, and that's where I'm plugging Myers-Briggs. They do a modified Myers-Briggs. You can do a Kersey Bates if you want to, which everyone can do, and experiences.
Network is similar, but network is missing the experiences side. That bugs me about network, and that's why I think you can rework it. You can rework in terms of addresses and stuff. Write McIntyre. He can get you. He can tell you where to find all this, or you can write me at the seminary, and I can give you names and addresses where you get that stuff.
Our own ELCA just released a piece to every congregation. Not too bad.
I haven't seen it.
Yeah, it's out of that discipleship. Resource that just came to every congregation this fall. There's some pretty decent stuff in that.
On spiritual gifting?
On spiritual gifts.
Yeah, that came out. The Intersections.
No, you have to be your own bridge.
Intersections is a new book. I just want to share our curriculum study group did Dallas Willard's Spirit of the Disciplines based on Herman Van Orden, who was a Reformed pastor and met with us for years before he moved back to Iowa. Kept encouraging us, and us Lutheran pastors said, you know, finally he left and we said, well, maybe we should listen to Harlan. This guy's a Southern Baptist,
Baptist.
There's some points at which I would really contend with him. He presents the 17 disciplines. During Lent, I presented those to my people. Now, how I would have done it different is I would have said, this is what it is, and then had them experience it. Instead of talking about it, which we Lutherans tend to do, we talk rather than experience. But it's intrigued, not my whole congregation, like you say, there's some that don't care about that. But it has challenged some of the other ones. So when the Intersections came out, we're doing, for example, Faith by Dr. Martin E. Marty. It's supposed to be 6 sessions long. We did it twice a month throughout the summertime. We're only in the middle of chapter 3. People are telling their stories. We're starting to pray for people. It's just a small group at this point, but it's amazing how those people are attending regularly, because there is an immense craving for this. And I'm just looking at the logical stuff of that. I think the spirit of the disciplines about Dallas Willard, if you want to hear something about the disciplines, that's a book to study.
I almost put that off here, but I said, no, he's a Southern Baptist. I can't go that far.
Well, and that's why we resisted it.
Yeah, I know.
Because we were afraid of that. Just one final point. I think the biggest thing between legalism and discipleship, because I have started, since I read that book, not talking about being believers. I've talked about being disciples with my people. And that's made a change. We aren't in an evangelism explosion in any way. But I think it's beginning to have an effect in the congregation to say, yeah, maybe I am called to something more than just believing in Jesus. I'm called actually to be a disciple. And I think the thing that corrects the legalism is when you sit there and say, and Dallas makes this very clear, you aren't doing the disciplines in order to be doing the disciplines. You're doing the disciplines in order to say, how can God touch you?
That's right.
How is God working?
And ultimately, the purpose of the disciplines become to make you the kind of vessel that God can use to make a difference in the world. Ultimately, it's even service-oriented. The purpose of the disciplines is not internal, but service-oriented. I want to add just another little thing that I'm fairly persuaded, we didn't do the studies on this, and I wanted to, but I'm fairly persuaded that as spiritual growth, however we want to use that language, I know it's dangerous stuff, but as spiritual growth happens, we can't measure it, but spiritual growth and the using of their spiritual gifts, there will also be a significant increase in their financial support for the church. That people, once their lives are being changed, they want to invest the resources of their lives into what it is that's making a difference in their lives. Because they have an investment. They have an investment. Those things work together kind of like a triangle. Which book? Dallas Willard. W-I-L-L-A-R-D. Dallas Willard. It's called
The Spirit of the
Disciplines. The Spirit of the Disciplines.
And if you have we have a Pericope study group that not only studies the Pericopes, but we do a book study. And we back open some books from Jack Black. That Jack is part of that. And I don't know what you've done in the Spirit of the Disciplines. But that's what I use it for, and I know we resisted it for years, but we respect Harlan so much that eventually he said,
he wrote that book. He's a good friend of Richard Foster,
He wrote that book as a theological undergirding to celebration of discipline by Richard Foster. And so they are actually a pair that go together. Dallas Willard is professor of religion at Southern California, the School of Religion at USC, University of Southern California.
I just wanted to say something about, I was excited about what you've been saying, because I'm a pastor in Vancouver, British Columbia, PLCIC, and we have, over the last couple of years, have a program for the adult catechumens that is going very well. We have the process of preparing people for baptism and for affirmation baptism. And our whole, the ministry of the whole congregation, people who are coming in, have a sponsor. I'm in class right now of 10 people, and half of the people on that are long-time members. The other half are new people. And so we're going to walk the faith together.
And how long does it last?
Well, it lasts a fair bit. It can be for a year, it could be for 6 months.
This is the program that I've heard of. I think John Meyer was doing this at the Penny Ridge. I just tried
to
remember something.
And just to help with among our resources is a new book that's written by one of our pastors who really brings up some topics and sometimes to the pastors because then we can develop the program. This book, Praying Catechism, is in the Golden Master Store. And
Don Johnson?
The post-training catechism is kind of challenging our Lutheran idea of learning up here, memorizing the catechism, and making it out of the heart rather than the head. And another thing that's really exciting in this, and I have to be on the synodical team for developing doing workshops within the DC Synod. And we have just been invited to go into one of our most high-stakes conversations, one with whom we have had no
connection.
Because we're all kind of high-stakes people, they are not at all. And they always do this with suspect because they don't need to be quite people, you know, we had that feeling anyway. Now they are seeing the program, they are excited, they want us to move and go there and to get in and do a workshop and help that congregation to care to do what we do. And I define that. So we kind of, we talked about being in the seminary.
Yes.
So that, it's kind of like we found a place where we have some connection.
Yes. Yes.
Before we did not have.
I think that's the model, and that's the model that we're talking about. It's a model that 20 years down the road may be totally passe. It's only a model. You know, I don't want to give it more credit than it's due by any means, but I really do feel that we are in an age where people want to take their faith seriously. And I don't want to put it in legalism, grace, obedience. I don't want to put it in any of those terms. Many want to take their faith seriously, whether they're seekers who are coming for the very first time, or whether they're members of your church who've been sitting in the pews for 20 years. There's a hunger for this. And Timothy referenced it last night. And I think they're looking for quality, and they're looking for something that is, and this is where the pietistic side comes in. They're looking for something that's experiential. It's experiential, and it's not just rote.
After the baptism, affirmation baptism, there's another 6 week program for vocation.
Yes.
How am I going to live out my life now that I am as a Christian in the world?
I believe that things like this are absolutely going to turn loose the land. That we, it, far from all the stuff we were debating this morning, which I think is significant. In fact, this is one of the things. Luther, I think we're debating the wrong issues. We are fighting tooth and nail over worship. And I think we need to pull back and look again at how we live the Christian life and what it means as Lutherans to live the Christian life. And I think we're debating the wrong issue. This will happen in a liturgical church. It'll happen in a church that has drums and rock and roll. I think we're finding the wrong thing. That's my opinion. But my colleague here is very much into worship and evangelism. But that's just the truth. Please.
Yeah. I'd like to respond to your question by getting at your initial question, and I can do that best in the Swedish context where I was a parish priest. I was very impressed in going there to know that the gospel had been preached according to Lutheran criteria in its purity for centuries, huh? And the society is full of guilt, and you can't criticize the Swede because they're so self-critical that they aren't living up to a certain standard, and therefore they're not acceptable. And I asked, how is this possible? You know, that the population for generations has been hearing the gospel, and this is what the society is full of. And what I discovered is that when I got up to do the confession of sins before Mass, I got the strange feeling that people were sitting there saying, yeah, you forgive me, Pastor, but if you knew what I really was like and what I really did, that I'm a shit, you wouldn't be saying you're forgiven. And the only way I could deal with that was starting a small group, and lo and behold, much to my amazement, people started sharing their stories. And then I discovered in that little castle chapel that suddenly you got a feeling that the confession in the yes. Eucharist was functioning. They understood it because they didn't experience themselves being accepted when they told all their crap.
But
apart from that, there was no way of getting that across. I could preach and I was blue in the face.
This is what 12 steps have discovered, by the way. I mean, the 12 steps are the priests, the 12 steps groups are the priests that perform the priest function.
And I have concluded, like Luther, no ecclesiola, no church. You can have Mass with the beautiful service, it isn't going to work until they have this kind of experience. But getting to your question, one of the things we started asking is, okay, what's your mission? Well, it's to identify sin in your life. And this is was my anti-pietist critique. Not the sin in your own personal word, but where do you experience hurt out there? Where is sin damaging people, and where are you aware of it? And then how can you repent? By which you meant, not how can I tell God how I'm sorry I am, but what can I do in that situation of hurt to bring reconciliation, whether I'm responsible or not. That's not the question. If there hurts there, how can I bring reconciliation? And then you come back, and my conviction was that people grow in their spiritual life by the way they engage the situation in their daily work life. Right, and then they come back in the group, and together with the group, reflect on what was the meaning of that, and what do I need to do? Now, don't tell me what to do, but help me understand what I need to do next week when I go out there and in that situation.
We're not discovering this. Latin America with the basic ecclesial communities have been doing this for within the Catholic Church for decades upon decades. And Lionel Coleman and the Evangelicals have been doing this for 40 years. You know, either direction you look Catholic, you look Evangelical, this stuff's all being done. Lyman Coleman, with serendipity in their materials, he's simply an explosion of small groups, church-wide, across the country, that's just so overwhelmed him that he has had, you know, he has had to back out personally. But he says, you know, it's a stat error. He said, for 35 years I've been preaching in small groups and no one listens. And all of a sudden, all of America wakes up. And it's everywhere. It is literally everywhere. Now, there is a critique of small groups which is absolutely significant. And it's written by Robert W. Wuthnow. Thank you. Can't say his name. And it's called, it's a red book. It's pretty recent. It's just come out. Oh, shoot. It's hard that. I don't know, I can't remember, but it's a critique of, and what it, it's a critique of 12-step movement as being the sole source of people's experience of Christianity, because what they can do then is create Christianity in the mode that they want it. And there is a danger to small groups, that there is not the confessionalism, there is not the outside criteria, the orthodoxy, whatever you want to call it, that holds every group accountable. And 12 steps, if you don't like what this group's saying, I'll just go to another group. Now that's the reality of America as well. But he has a good critique. He loves small groups, but he has a very healthy critique of what's going on. But it's mostly directed at the 12 step. And I don't find it directed at the local church as much as at the 12 step. But it's a very, very healthy critique. Please.
Maybe the answer to your first question, you know, about why our faith is undeveloped is that we lack the honesty within that. You know, we've lacked a confession. We haven't been able to come into a Bible study and say, this is really my life.
Well,
you know, we haven't been honest and confession. Because Luther, the Catholic, you said the Catholics are doing it. They have confession. You said the Evangelicals are doing it. They are willing to meet themselves and say, I've been bad and I was going to be good. But yeah. Maybe Lutherans never did that. Lutherans always came and said, we're
okay. Well, I don't know. I don't know if that's true. I think Lutherans beat themselves up pretty badly, and that's why I really do believe in grace. But I think we do. It's all corporate. That's what I'm talking. We've thrown all our eggs in the basket of worship. And this study was simply calling for adult education. I'm moving beyond that. I think we need much more than education. And this is where I like the Catholic concept of spiritual formation. That we are talking about forming. We are talking about a practical life where related to their life of what's going on in their lives. So please.
Is in his steps program, is it available?
It is, but it's so, again, what I encourage you to get the spirit, it's such an odd beast. I basically, what I do is I create 6 Bible studies on prayer, and then I do 6 practical sessions on how to pray. I teach them how to pray in a group. I teach them how to listen quietly. I teach them how to center themselves. Just very practical things.
Do you have written materials on all these
sessions? Do we?
I wish he had more.
We do, yeah, but it's almost unpublishable, I think. I hate to publish stuff. I would hate to publish stuff like this because it becomes,
It becomes Methodistic.
You see, the problem, this is the whole problem of renewal movements, and if we ever, this is why I'm a pietist, but I always say I'm a first generational pietist. The problem with pietism happened with second generation. The problem with the charismatic movement happened with second generation. I believe the problem with the peace and justice movement is going to happen in the second generation. It becomes legalistic. In the first generation, it's passion. And people catch the passion. In the second generation, the things that they believed get handed on, but you can't hand on the passion. You can't hand on the experience. And I think it's true with every single renewal movement. I think it happened with Jesus. You find the apostolic fathers and mothers, but they are men and fathers, in the late 1st and early 2nd century, are much more legalistic. They're much more legalistic. And they, in the 2nd and the 3rd... Look at the Book of Concord! Absolutely, look at the Book of Concord, no question. Look at, one of the things that Wesley had the advantage of is he lived 91 years.
To keep the second generation
inspired. He kept the second generation inspired. So, I mean, we're going to run it. That's why I hate to just hand off things like that. I suppose...
We could send out a description of the program, but it really would need to be delivered in a contextual way. There are any number of models for small groups. Discipleship to help deliver the practice of the Christian faith, to help people practice it with each other.
I'd be happy to come. I really do believe in this. And actually, I will say this honestly, I deeply miss the pastoral ministry. I really miss the pastoral ministry. And I've only been gone for 2 weeks, but I really do miss it. Yes.
I just wanted to respond to the individual confession because one of the my father was Lutheran pastor in Missouri Synod. I knew him. Amazing thing was we compared notes of 3 things that were distinctive between his and mine: the expectations of the pastors are enormous, and that's why we need to develop lay spiritual. Number 2, the number of adult baptisms I've done says the climate's changed versus almost none. All different. Number 3, probably the other biggest thing is he never did individual confession. And more I opened myself up because of some training by Frank Sandbeck at Seminary to doing individual confession. And it's been amazing the reaction I've gotten from that. Using Prism Oil like James Clark too. also. And I was telling Dalvin Dennis that I almost cried remembering some of them, because some of them, it's like the people received it and it kind of seeps into them. And they said, you know, I didn't think it was that big a deal, but you know,
yep.
It has become more and more meaningful to me. Where others, it's literally they get snotty.
I know.
You know, and you do too.
Oh yes.
And then you stand in the stead of Jesus Christ, not because I am, but because I'm called to that, and anoint them and promise, you know, give them that assurance of grace and forgiveness. And when you said one-on-one is where it needs to happen.
Yes.
Now, I don't want to remove the general confession, but I think as people have individual experiences, that general confession becomes very, very liturgically powerful.
It's like the secret of the 12 steps, too.
It is, very much.
You know, they have to say everything they've done, and then they have to have somebody else give them
One of the things that's happened in his steps is that, and it doesn't happen all the time, but it's happened like 3 or 4 times, people have gone through in his steps and have recognized that what they really need is personal counseling. And part of why I'm in personal counseling is that I don't, at this time in my life, feel like all of the dark secrets are something that I want to pour out on a small group of people. And so my counselor is my confessor. And I am processing all the stuff that I didn't think I could tell to anybody. And the tears, and the weeping, and what's there. And I've needed that for my own self, for me, as I hear others, and let others tell their story. Now, could I risk sharing that in a small group? I think, ultimately, I probably could, if it was a safe group of people who were not members of my church. But, that gets different. But that's the relationship to me of counseling and spiritual direction as well. That there are times when people go through stuff like this, and it's happened at least twice that I know of, especially with men. And men have come and they've said, you know, I've got to get into counseling.
I want to share an insight from a psychiatrist colleague, and I think it's just a wonderful affirmation in the church. He said, I know where people are coming to confession in the 90s. They're coming to me, psychiatrist counselors. They're not going to their pastor for the most part. But then his insight to the church was, but he said, I struggle with it because I cannot offer absolution. Absolution is the experience of the church. You have to be restored into community and in your wholeness.
Into community, that's right.
And that is, I think, a wonderful insight into again, the power of small group and the power of the church in the 90s. It's not enough to hear absolution from your psychiatrist.
No.
The experience to be restored to community.
My experience with counseling has helped me to be more vulnerable with my people. And that, you know, the things that I didn't think I could share with them, I have shared with them, and it has opened up a level of vulnerability. And I think that I really agree with, that there need to be, see, I like organized small groups. I don't like I'm not the type of person who just says, get some people together and have them tell their stories. You know, I like liturgies. I like, you know, I like organization. I like words of absolution within the small group so that the community forgives and welcomes and restores, et cetera, as best they can. But you have to also be very, very careful with this. You don't have trained therapists as your small group leaders. And they have got to also learn to recognize dysfunction and other issues that people need help that we can't possibly offer them in small groups. And that's part of the danger of us toying with these things that we really don't know about. And that's why I have not gotten into doing a lot of rape survivor groups and things like that, because it's way beyond, at this point, the kind of training that our leaders need to have for the function.
They're also not going to find enough absolution in the 12-step groups because God, as you understand it, just doesn't cut it.
Right. Well, God can be a doorknob, and that's perfectly fine. And that is, we offer much more than that.
Right.
We offer much more than that. Thank you. Jesus, you've been so patient.